Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour, Paul Buell.
Thank you very much.
Well, you've written extensively on the history of radicalism and labor in the U.S., including a number of important works on McCarthyism and union organizing in Hollywood. We're going into the fourth month now of the Writers Guild of America strike and the second month of SAG-AFTRA strike, the Screen Actors Guild and the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists. These strikes have brought much of the television and film industry to a halt and have generated wide support and solidarity as workers in other sectors see their own struggles in these unions' demands. So, Paul Buell, as a labor historian, what are some of the lessons that come to mind from earlier eras of union organizing and fights in Hollywood?
But let me go back to the 1930s, the glory of the old days, because it's a useful way to look at things. The Screen Actors Guild was earlier in being able to organize because a number of stars in the later 30s took the lead, and they had therefore more bargaining power with the studios. The Writers Guild, the Screenwriters Guild, as it was then called, had a much harder struggle, but by the end of the 1930s, managed to make some headway thanks to the National Labor Relations Act and the National Labor Relations Board, which was created by Franklin D. Roosevelt's New Deal. You could say, and you wouldn't be wrong to say, that during World War II, the unions were at the apex of their influence, both because the government was urgent to get collaboration of movie makers with the patriotic anti-fascist cause, and because the left in Hollywood, led by communists, but by no means only communists, was able to push its own strength to the max. It was in the leadership of the Screenwriters Guild, and was its leading activists were often the officers of the Screen Actors Guild. It was a natural thing at the time, and though people didn't know that Ronald Reagan was an undercover FBI agent or informant, nevertheless, he too would attend meetings led by the Communist Party, as many people sought to forget later on. So it was a great popular cause, anti-fascism, and then comes 1945, 1946, the beginning of the Cold War, and there's congressional investigations that actually begin as early as 1939, 1940, by the Committee to House Un-American Activities Committee, and it aims both to identify and isolate communists, but it also is extremely anti-Semitic in congressional addresses and the way the communist influence was described to be in Hollywood. Well, after World War II, these things come up again, and they are resisted significantly. In one of my books, Radical Hollywood, I note that in 1947, a large meeting in Los Angeles and Gilmore Stadium, it would have been in the Hollywood Bowl, but they were turned down, called Hollywood Fights Back, led by Katharine Hepburn, followed by almost every leading star in Hollywood, except the very reactionary ones, like John Wayne, to attack the oncoming McCarthyism and to support the right of Hollywoodites to make their own choice. The first person to speak was Katharine Hepburn, and she said, "Silence the artist and you silence the most articulate voice the people have. Destroy culture and you destroy one of the strongest sources of inspiration from which a people can draw strength to fight for a better life." Well, this was markedly unsuccessful, and soon the congressional investigations of leading Hollywood writers began and accelerated, as did the investigations by 1950, during which quite a number of actors and writers were effectively blacklisted, denied work in their professions. In fact, the Screenwriters Guild and the Screen Actors Guild blacklisted their own members. Now, I should go back and point to the strike of 1945-46 and one significant fact within that strike.
What unions were involved in that strike?
The Screen Actors Guild, Screenwriters Guild, and the Conference for Studio Unions that included, very importantly, a dissonant group within IATSE, the Stagehands group. Now, it's crucial to know that at that point in its history, probably until 1960, IATSE, as it was called, was effectively a mob union. It was controlled by the mob, but worked closely with management in Hollywood. And during that strike, it broke picket lines with the help of the Teamsters, who then were, as members of the American Federation of Labor, bitterly opposed to the CIO, the more progressive industrial union section of labor. So between IATSE and the Teamsters, the strike of the Conference of Studio Unions was broken. And in many ways, this foreshadows the McCarthy era, because the labor unions did not have the unity to move ahead. Now, the next important things happen around 1950, partly because Ronald Reagan is the head of the Screen Actors Guild and effectively purges all of the unwanted members, including those who had never been communists but simply refused to give testimony against their friends. And he also abolishes the Committee to Advance Non-Whites within the Screen Actors Guild, which left-wing people had been very much involved with. Now, in his regime, a sweetheart deal was worked out between the Screen Actors Guild and the motion picture studios. So much so, this is a little complicated, but I'll try to explain it. I'm quoting from Hide in Plain Sight, The Hollywood Blacklistees in Films and Television, 1950 to 2002, which was a sequel to my earlier book, also with journalist, blacklisted journalist Dave Wagner, titled Radical Hollywood, The Untold Story Behind America's Favorite Movies. So this is from Hide in Plain Sight. The Screen Actors Guild had traditionally used its leverage to fight against the practice of talent agencies also acting as producers, on the logical basis that such a conflict of interest would be sure to create a monster that would devour the dream that someday creative control would repose or come into the hands of the artists. In 1952, the Screen Actors Guild, under Reagan's presidency, made a giant exception for MCA. The very next year, MCA's production company hired Reagan to host GE Theater, its flagship program, giving him the exposure and corporate financial backing he needed to launch his major career. As a result of the deal and centralizing production, within a decade, MCA produced 60% of all primetime television shows in the United States. A Justice Department hearing in 1962 into this extraordinary development might have ended Reagan's career if they'd pressed them, but they didn't ask that kind of question. And potential strikes over a variety of issues continue to be threatened by the flat refusal of IATSE leaders to honor picket lines, just as in 1945-46 during the Conference of Studio Unions strike.
Just to insert the explanation, IATSE is the union of a lot of the technical and stage workers in Hollywood and camera operators.
That's correct.
And you're saying they have their own complex political history that was quite conservative at the time.
It was a man named Roy Brewer took over the IATSE shortly before 1940. IATSE itself was begun by a mob unionist in Chicago, and as it exerted power in Hollywood, it was largely and correctly thought of as a union that was more connected with mob than it was with organized labor. Later, by 1970, the mob influence and Roy Brewer, who personally made it impossible to show films written or directed by blacklisted writers or directors, actually shown in the U.S. Roy Brewer had passed from the scene, and IATSE passed into the hands of less reactionary, more progressive people. And once that happened, then IATSE's collaboration with the Screen Actors Guild and the Screenwriters Guild could proceed, which has made a very great difference. Likewise, once the reactionary role of the Teamsters breaking the strikes of Hollywoodites had come to an end, then the Teamsters could support SAG and AFTRA. And that also makes a crucial difference coming up to now. I could turn to 1960 to perhaps anticipate your next question. And 1960, there's the strike, the last SAG-AFTRA strike that was a coordinated strike between the two of those. That strike was about the very issue that's involved today, more or less, which is SAG and AFTRA wanted residuals paid for movies that had been made between 1948 and 1960. Getting those residuals would make a great difference, especially to older actors, or really to all actors. The studio unions absolutely refused. And in return, they made a large contribution. Maybe it was $16 million, then a great deal of money, to a fund for actors' benefits and welfare. And on that basis, and not being able to go any further with that strike or a threatened strike, the unions agreed to that settlement. 1960, Ronald Reagan retires, and that too lifts a burden off of the unions and makes it possible for progressives to have a much larger role in the unions. You could say that by the 1970s and 1980s, there are various people who were presidents, including Charlton Heston, who's a very reactionary president, and several other actors and actresses who were very progressive presidents. But at least you can say they struggled to represent actors and represent the people behind the scenes, the writers and directors, in a more consistent and union-like fashion.
This is Jan Hocken talking today with Paul Buell, labor historian, about the history of Hollywood and unionism. So, Paul Buell, what do you see as the next chapter in both the conservative and the progressive forces behind Hollywood unions and strikes?
Ed Asner, who was the co-star of the Mary Tyler Moore Show and went on to play his own show, Lou Grant, 1977 to 1982. And he's an extremely consequential person, both because he was the most left-wing president of the SAG since the later 1940s, and also because he was the leading left-wing figure within the AFL-CIO's Executive Council at a time when the U.S. was assaulting Central America. And the struggle over Nicaragua was particularly hot. Now, Lou Grant was a show that took on corporate power and U.S. foreign policy in a remarkable fashion, unprecedented for television. So Ed Asner was quite the hated figure by Charlton Heston and John Wayne and others of the old right, and quite a hated figure by the Executive Council members of the AFL-CIO, with the exception of William Wimpersinger, the head of the Machinists. So every progressive campaign in those days around foreign policy and other matters found Ed Asner at the center of that struggle. So you can say he represents a new era for the Screen Actors Guild. And the next point really important for historians at any rate comes in 1996, when at the Academy Awards ceremony, Kirk Douglas takes the stage and wishes to deal with the Hollywood past. As Steven Spielberg narrated the history of Hollywood's most important issues, films on social issues, the film clips that the celebrity audience watched and cheered revealed a strangely familiar pattern. Most of the films chosen had been written by victims of the blacklist, for Douglas and other outspoken progressives like him. No one said so in front of the microphone, but in that audience, everybody knew. Recovering from a severe stroke, Douglas determined to make his appearance at the ceremony and listen respectfully while Spielberg narrated the Lifetime Achievement Award he was about to hand the old star, saying he's directed, he produced it, and in the process, he helped to hammer the Blacklist to pieces. Douglas, in his struggling way with the stroke, basically just said, breaking the Blacklist was the only thing I was really proud of. Now, this is a big, big moment for Hollywood actors and Hollywood writers. In the end of the 20th century, the 50th anniversary of when the Blacklist began in 1947, a lot had taken place. By the end of the century, there was an effort to restore the credits that had been taken away from actors, but mainly from writers and directors and people behind the camera. And it seemed as if Hollywood was trying to come to terms with its own history, including the history of Cold War involvements. Does this end the involvement of U.S. intelligence agencies in Hollywood? No, we've learned a lot about that since, none of whose details I really know much about. But nevertheless, if it's said today that militants in the Screen Actors Guild and the Writers Guild have a sense of their history, this is the most definitely part of this sense of their history, so that they march forward with a sense of militant unionism, but also with a sense of what they must do in order to win this battle and how they must defeat red baiting and every other sort of charge that's been thrown at actors and writers in the past.
There's one tradition of unionism that is advanced by the history of the American Federation of Labor, AFL, that's more limited business unionism, more of an aristocratic vision, and then the CIO representing a broader craft vision, a broader vision of social unionism and solidarity across different unions and sectors of work. Could you say something about those two trajectories and their politics over time, and whether you see hope in the current labor struggles for that broader vision of social unionism?
Right. Well, as you suggest, and though there are exceptions, the AFL represented white male craft workers only, and their leadership from the 1880s, 1890s onward was to keep non-whites and women out of the labor movement, to restrict to also, they were bitterly against any new immigration. That was very important to them. And politically, with some exceptions, very reactionary, even during the 1930s and the New Deal. The CIO, a Congress of Industrial Organizations, came out of the industrial union movement of the 1930s, including the sit-downs, not only famous ones in Michigan, but little remembered ones all the way down to the south through Ohio and up to the north. And it had well-represented groups of various left-wingers, the most important of which was the Communist Party, but also very much the fraternal organizations around the what we call the Popular Front. You just think of something like the American Slav Congress, made of Slovenes, Croats, and Serbs. It had tens of thousands of members in the 1940s, especially in the state of Pennsylvania, and played a crucial role in the Steelworkers Union. And there were numbers of other unions like that whose members were born in various parts of Europe or other parts of the world, and who saw the struggle against anti-fascism as important as their own struggle for union recognition. That's really what's crucial in the 1940s. And when we come to the Red Scare of the 1950s, it was to drive the progressives out. It destroyed the union drive to organize the South and turned the leadership back in the direction of collaboration with U.S. foreign policies abroad, so that the AFL-CIO merger, that is the AFL merging with a CIO that had been purged of its left wing, was more like the AFL's conservatism swallowing up the CIO's progressivism and put labor in the hands, in part, of U.S. foreign policy operations, and very much including the CIA, but also of the whole dependency on the Democratic Party to do anything whatsoever. The willingness to strike was very limited, and the eagerness to elect a Democrat and avoid almost anything else was a predominant thought. So that by the 1960s and 70s, when there were a lot of rebellions, Democratic rebellions against conservative union leadership, these were slapped down by an AFL-CIO leadership that supported the Vietnam War 100% and made every effort to crush dissent. So things sort of continued sliding downward as industries began to disappear in the face of NAFTA in particular. There are fewer and fewer members, and the only breakthroughs are sectors that had not been particularly liked by labor leadership, including white-collar workers, teachers, women in various clerical jobs, and non-whites. Those are the only bright spots within a pretty dark picture of unionism. This comes to a close, in a sense, in 1996, when there's a so-called palace revolution to overthrow the corrupt and fumbling leadership of the AFL-CIO. And although things had fallen so far that it was very difficult to build back up, several progressive unions did their best. I'm thinking of the hotel and restaurant workers and several others. And in a sense, unions began to regain some of the energy that they'd lost during the first 20 years of the new century. But it's remarkable, as people who are on the scenes of this strike or in committee meetings with strike supporters, it's remarkable to see how clear-minded, radical, militant, and united the SAG members and the AFTRA actors and members are, really. They represent the best of the labor movement, along with the Teamsters now in negotiation. And the two of those are really bright spots in a much, much smaller labor movement. And if there's something which offers promise, it certainly is those unions.
You know, but before we close, I'd like to also hear your thoughts on some of the dynamics and challenges in sustaining strikes over a long period of time, and whether, you know, it's anyone's guess what's happening now, but there's always this question, looking back on social movements that have bitter failures, they're crushed, strikes that have modest gains or fail altogether. What's your sense of what's involved in sustaining a successful labor action, as it particularly now enjoys pretty broad support? It's kind of a summer of labor love in a way. There are other strikes, the hotel workers in Los Angeles, teachers and nurses and other service workers have also been active through their unions. What do you see as the critical issues in sustaining a strike, particularly over a number of months? It's daunting.
Yeah. Let's go back to the vision of the Writers Guild, SAG, and AFTRA. And their vision from the 1930s and 1940s on was that someday the creative people would in some way control their own creations. That was the most important thing about their vision. Of course, the producers and the bankers and so forth, they had the very opposite vision, to turn these people into the least influential part of the industry. But having the vision that it was possible for writers and actors, but also stagehands and all others involved in the process, to collaboratively create a meaningful art for the audiences, not only here but abroad, was a tremendous idea. And that kind of idea allowed people to struggle against great odds and to hold their heads high through the struggle. Now, I think this is true of the union movement at large. Not only is it to do something in the present day, most especially for writers and actors and so forth, to defend against the threat of oncoming super automation and reducing their roles in addition to their money dramatically, but likewise in the Teamsters and other unions have a vision of a different kind of society, a society not entirely dependent upon profit, in which the rich don't get richer and richer. That's the kind of vision of a transformed society that can allow unions and unionists to take defeats march ahead, to hold on, to build solidarity, to recognize their unity with other working people, both in the U.S. and abroad. And if that is indeed the heart of the message today, I suppose this comes back to Occupy, and in my own experience, to the Wisconsin struggles of 2011, 2012, which were all about defending unionized workers against new threats to them, then I think we've got something. We've really got something.
Well, that's a wonderful, wise, and encouraging note to stop on today. This is Jan Hawken talking with Paul Buell about the history of labor in Hollywood and the lessons of that history. Thank you so much for being with us, Paul.
Thank you.